but the election becomes a grand public itself.
When I have a person of the eminence of Professor Srikandan, let me mention fully, Madanaval Venkata Subba Srikandan, we are truly fortunate. So, with the help of some friends here, I collected some of the photographs. Of course, large number of photographs showing. But what you see is one thing, that age cannot wither. He has grown young as the years go by. And some of the pictures captured, you can see the picture, and even today, he's a real role model. So, in doing this, I must thank Professor Sishil Roy, because he was the one who suggested originally to him, he was interacting with him on some of the topic and a lecture. But he is conveniently absent today, so I have been propelled into this position of moderating this lecture. So many things have to happen for this. I called him a voyager in cosmos. His life is a remarkable life. He started out in physics in Bangalore University here, and then joined the institute very briefly. That's a very critical period, if I may say so. He spent a few months,
one year,
in the electrical communication engineering. And that is what brought him into touch with Baba and others. He was then taken to atomic energy, where he was asked questions in mathematics, physics and statistics. He answered all of them well. He was also asked, is it theory that you like or experiment? He said both. And apparently Baba said, there are very few people who like experiments, so let us take him, let us not do this. And if you look at him, he is going to talk about it, so I shouldn't really preempt any of his ideas. He has searched for this muons up in the Ooty telescopes and so on, down below in Kolar Goldfield. He has worked in MIT, he has worked in Japan. It's a most colorful life. And all through his dedication, his thirst for knowledge and thirst for creation of new knowledge. He just doesn't read and just stay quiet, but likes to create new knowledge, ask questions. And I feel it's almost predestined that in this phase of his life, he should be with us at NIAS. We are most fortunate in that. In coming here, he suddenly took interest in consciousness. And we know now that cosmos and consciousness are closely linked. Some of his lectures may even touch upon that. That the two things, the very vast one and the very small one, are linked together. So he is a thinker. He has given a number of lectures over the years, and each time we have learnt in that. So his enthusiasm, his interest in knowledge, and his ability to show all of us is remarkable. So I salute him and would like him now to delight us with his lecture, which is quite close to his heart. He has been going through the subject, we have been exchanging, in fact, many things and so on and so forth. I am really very happy that we are able to arrange a lecture of this type and offer it to the citizens of Bangalore. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Ranganathan. Whatever I have been able to do, I must first of all make it clear, is not because of any great great things that I have in me. It's essentially because I have had excellent opportunities and I have had very good colleagues. In fact, all my, if you look at my number of publications, there may be four or five publications individual as far as publications are concerned. The rest are all along with my colleagues and students. So, and also I had excellent colleagues in the, at the cost, in TIFR and atomic energy, which made possible at a time when I was also very lucky to be working in this field of higher energy physics, higher energy astronomy, at a time when the field was just, started, and then we had opportunities to do, contribute something to a field which was just emerging. And today, when I look at CERN career, I find that the skill and scale of experiments is so large. I wanted to highlight that aspect in today's lecture, essentially because the old style of doing research is practically vanishing. It's very difficult. In fact, I remember C.V. Raman used to say that he discovered Raman effect spending just 4,000 rupees for a spectrograph. a kind of a thing. But today, what is 4,000 rupees basically kind of a... That was also a Nobel Prize lecture, he got Nobel Prize for his work on Raman effect. So today, anybody who gets Nobel Prize, one of them will get out of 1,200 or 1,500 collaborating scientists. You see, he will have to spend billions of dollars, trillions of dollars now it is coming to. But the point is this, the way science is moving, they are not stopping. Can you imagine that, I'll just talk about it a little later, 70,000 tons of liquid argon for one experiment in a deep underground mine. See, we had small detectors and we could do something 50 years ago. But today, there's a collaboration between America and some countries in Europe, France and then Switzerland and all this, to make a detector for detection of neutrinos, which will involve 70,000 tons of liquid argon, basically. I mean, the scale of experiments have completely changed. And so I thought, in recent times, you know, two of the major experiments, one was the detection of gravitational waves, and the other one, of course, four years ago, the production of Higgs boson. Both these are really Nobel Prize winning discoveries. But how much effort has gone before these experiments is absolutely fantastic. Part of it I want to reflect in my lecture today. That and also the way the future is being planned by these countries. I don't think we can ever cope up with it unless we change our way we do things. Or, as Baba used to tell us when we started work, don't worry about competition, but think where you have some advantage and cash on it. In fact, when the radio astronomy telescope was built in Ooty, that type of telescope cannot be built except on the equator and it can't be built in America or South America because of the inclination that is required, and mechanically it's not possible to support a telescope like that. Then Swaroop designed a telescope which is suitable for 7 degrees, which is manageable by it. So that's the way we have to think of the future. What is the direction in which we should go? Of course, one thing is we are also becoming part of this large, for example, there is going to be this large array, LIGO, Indigo as they are calling it now, for detection of the future detection of gravity waves. That's also a very expensive, 1,400 crores has been, I'm told, sanctioned for that thing. But compared to the old days, money is required in enormous quantities. That is quite obvious from the way they are going about it. And more than that, technological development. In fact, if you see some of the developments that are taking place in detector technology and in various in electronics technology, you just can't imagine the way we used to struggle in the old days and what is happening today. And most of this equipment, if you have the money, you can buy it. That's the kind of situation. So you may get a good idea, and if you have the money, then you can buy the equipment and finish the experiment in a very short time. But there are also these other projects, some of which will need enormous amount of collaboration by a very large group of people. The other aspect I want to stress in today's lecture is that there has to be the present day experimentation is very different from what it was 50 years ago or 60 years ago. See, if then a pi meson was discovered as a new particle, if the whole record was there, the pi would stop in a photographic emulsion detector and then you would see the secondary going out of it. But today it is not like that. If you talk about the Higgs boson discovery, you see, it is the tertiary product of the whole scheme that you see. Then you go back and the theorists have worked out what should be the sequence of events and then what should be the directions in which they can come out and all. This is the kind of, for example, I'm going to show you how much of theory is there behind this gravitational wave detection. All that is seen is some from the point of view of just recording is trivial, but what they have got is a very, very significant observation. This I just wanted to, I took it from Stephen Hawking's book. Many of us, we don't care about science. We don't even ask questions about how is it that we are stable. See, there are so many atoms in our body. Why are they not just vibrating? And why are we sitting on the earth so solidly? Why is, if the gravitational force was not there, we would be going into space? So these are all matters on which, some people worry. Many, that's what Hawking says. You see, we go about daily lives understanding almost nothing of the world. We give little thought to the machinery that generates sunlight and make life possible, to the gravity that grooves us to the earth. Otherwise, we would it would send us spinning into space, all the atoms of which we are made, all on whose atoms are made, on whose stability we are fundamentally dependent. This is elementary science, but I think it is, many of us don't even worry about this. Of course, Ramchandran, I am sure most of you know about him, he writes, any ape can reach a banana, but only a human can reach the stars. That is what has been established now, you know. There is no limit to the, with the technology that is available today. This is one famous equation that Einstein wrote, which is called the general relativity equation. I am not going to talk about it because I don't know much about it. But all that I am going to talk about today in the next slides is all derived from that one equation, consequences of that one equation. One of the consequences of that equation is, for a long time nobody believed that this is true, is that you can have a point where the energy is infinite. For some reason which we don't know, this singularity of energy explodes. And in the explosion, all that, consequently, one after the other, all those things happen. You create a plasma, you create space, you create time. In fact, Einstein would say space-time continuum, not space and time separately. And then you have various kinds of plasma are created as a function of time. I'm going to talk about it a little more later. And then you have, ultimately, the stars come out from stars, and then the planets, and then, of course, the biological evolution that takes place on a planet like Earth and home. Finally, a human being comes out, thinking how all this has happened. It's only a human being that can do all this. Now, see, there is a shortest time interval according to quantum mechanics, which is 10 to the power of minus 43 seconds, which depends upon three constants of nature. But 10 to the power of minus 43 somehow is related to three constants of nature. One is velocity of light, which is a constant of nature. And the other is the H, which is Planck's constant. And the third one is G, the gravitational constant. You see, the interesting thing is quantum mechanics, in its very fundamentals, is closely related to G. G, which is the fundamental thing in Newton's equation, as a matter of fact. He's the first one to write that equation where you got the gravitational constant. Now, that gives you the smallest interval of time you can think of as 10 to the power of minus 43 seconds. And in that 10 to the power of minus 43 seconds, lots of things happen. The temperature, you see, the point is, I'm going to go forward and backward. You see, if you say, how do you know 10 to the power of 32 degrees temperature? I can only say it comes from all the knowledge that we have learned in thermodynamics, from particle physics, and all that much later. But today, one is able to construct a picture of what could have been, how the universe could have evolved, based upon even the latest information that we have from accelerators and also from astronomy. As a matter of fact, this whole expansion idea In fact, that equation which Einstein wrote, you know, he added a term called lambda, because in 1915 when he wrote that equation, he thought that the universe that is constant, that means the stars don't move, they are just stuck in their own places. The idea of expansion of the universe came after the telescopes in California were installed, 100-inch and 200-inch telescope. Then Hubble made the observation that the spectral lines were shifting. From that, he concluded that the universe is expanding. So the idea that universe is expanding, but Einstein, when he wrote down the equation, he found that the equation is such that it's not stable, the whole thing will explode. So to make the universe stable at that point of time, because the knowledge at that time was that the universe is stable, they're all stuck in there, he put in a constant called lambda. And then of course he said that lambda later on, when they pointed out that it is not required, because the same equations could be solved by others differently. He said it's the biggest blunder I made. That's the statement he made, introducing lambda. But today, you know, 50 years later, it's again that lambda that has come into focus. In fact, yesterday's paper you might have read that one of my colleagues from TIFR, and now he's at Padmanabhan, who is now in IUCA.
Tanu
Padmanabhan. He had taken a bet that this connected, you see, this whole universe expanding and now accelerating is connected with lambda. And some American astronomer had challenged him. But then finally he, after, I think he gave him 10 years time or something like that, and then finally agreed that the Padmanabhan is right. So he got his $200 or whatever it was. So you see, whole point is, the reason why I'm emphasizing this is, the way science is progressing is because of the knowledge that we have now, and we put back into the knowledge we had earlier, and use, for example, Einstein's equation is all 100 years old now, 1915. So the way knowledge is progressing depends upon feedback from what we have learned more recently and what was there before. Now, going further in this, you see the temperature, we started at 32 degrees, after expansion starts cooling. Initial expansion is very fast. It is not subjected to the limitation of the velocity of light, because space by itself can expand at any, according to those equations, there is no limit on the velocity with which space can. That's why it's called inflationary phase. And it enormously expands. And as a matter of fact, we say that the universe is 13.7 billion years old. That is only the visible universe. Actual universe could be something like, you see, you can have up to 60 billion years in space. And now they are trying to see beyond a certain limit to which the present telescopes can record things. They are trying to say that much more can be seen with improved technology. They are going to do that actually. Much bigger telescopes are being built, and in fact, fantastic, huge telescopes are coming up in Chile, in South America, and also in Hawaii. I mean, total amount of money that is being spent on science by other countries is fantastic actually. They all have hope that we will be able to find out ultimately every aspect of the universe. But ultimately, we realize at every point of time that we know so little. This temperature starts falling, and then various things happen in the plasma. That is what is described here. You start at some point of time, you start forming quarks. Quarks, you know, again, from experiments in high energy physics, experiments in cosmic rays, we finally came to the conclusion that particles, which we are all familiar with, like protons, neutrons, they are all made up of some smaller entities called quarks. And the quark formation is the first one that happens when this plasma starts cooling. And then those quarks have to combine and to form later on protons and neutrons, etc. But then how do they combine? Again, at that point of time, new force particles had to be generated. So that's the theory now. But that is what we say has happened. So the forces that bind the nuclear particles, the quarks, and then the forces that are responsible, strong force, weak force, in addition to the gravitational force, which started off the entire mischief, because it's the gravitational force in its mode of repulsive gravitation that is responsible for the explosion. And now, as it expands, this is a very beautiful thing, that gravitational energy is negative. And then now you can say that the total energy that you require for creating the universe is zero, because there's so much of negative energy that is created, but that negative energy that is created is by the explosion, basically. See, there are various types of quarks, and then the high energy physics has been able to pin down on all these properties of the quarks and so on to make different types of particles that are required to explain the properties of protons, neutrons and things like that. Then 20 years ago, or even no, actually 50 years ago, a surprising result came from astronomy. They have found that you cannot keep the stars in the galaxies, which are rotating, stable. There is not enough gravitational force there with the matter that you see in the form of ordinary matter. The ordinary matter gives light, and on the basis of that you can estimate what should be the total gravitational force in the. On the basis of that, they got a very surprising result that there is not enough matter. So how are the galaxies so held together? Galaxies, clusters of galaxies and so on. We, as you know, we are part of one galaxy, which is called the Milky Way, and we are at one corner. And there are 10 to the power of 11, hundreds of billions of galaxies are there. So how are these galaxies stable? Then they said the only way you can keep them stable is by putting in additional matter. That additional matter, if it was there in the form of the usual matter, what we call baryonic matter, in the form of protons, neutrons and electrons forming the nuclei, then we would have seen it, because they would be excited and or they would interact with particles which you know. They found absolutely not interacting. So they estimated that dark matter, as it is called, is 5 times the matter that we know. So this was a big blow to all that thing. See, and this opened up, now all the new experiments that are being done is in trying to identify what is this dark matter that surrounds the various galaxies. That is, of course, again, all these are universal. If dark matter is there in this room also, but the intensities are different, and nobody has been able to so far come out with any theory as to say what is this dark matter. But about the necessity of dark matter, there is no question, because they have not been able to find any mechanism by which they can hold the galaxies together. There's just not enough matter, because the galaxies are rotating and they should just move away, or the east star should go away, but it is not happening. So one of the major findings of was that the dark matter is 5 times that of ordinary matter. Then came another big surprise, that the universe has not only dark matter, but there is dark energy. The dark energy dominates, as a matter of fact, is 75% of the energy of the universe, even if you take dark matter into account, is in the form of an energy that we don't understand. And that is where some theories are thinking that this lambda of thing, and the Higgs boson field, or because they are the fields which create negative gravitation, because of which, see, they found the evidence for dark energy came in a very surprising way. That is, they found that some of the supernova which they recorded, you see, a standard candles in supernova, they give the same amount of output, the light, for certain type of supernova. And then they were not obeying the inverse square law in terms of absolute light they were putting out, absolute energy they were putting out. They were not according to the inverse square law. And that has been confirmed now, that there are supernova at very long distances which are running away from each other, as a matter of fact. And they estimated that to be able to do that, what is total amount of energy that the universe should have. And on the basis of that, they all accept now that the total amount of dark energy is 95%, and 5% dark energy and dark matter, and less than 5%, 2.2, I don't remember the figures are there. Very small amount is in the form of exotic dark matter is 26%, and 0.9%, and then ordinary is only 3.5%. So 3.5% of the universe is all that is available to us to do our experiments. The other 96.5%, you see, we don't know what they are. Complete ignorance. And most of the efforts today, very large scale experiments are there. And the problem is, if they were in charged particles, we would have detected them by now. There is no charged particle which is not detected, because there are plenty of detectors there and experimental arrangements you can design to detect them with magnetic fields and everything. But these are neutral particles. They are non-interacting. That is why they have assumed particles which are WIMPs, that is, weakly interacting massive particles. To account for this dark matter and dark energy in the universe, we are talking in terms of WIMPs, that is, weakly interacting massive particles. They have been searching for these massive interacting particles, production of it at all the accelerators. So far, they have not found any evidence for any such particle creation. Now they are looking for it in the Large Hadron Collider, in which they can produce particles like the Higgs boson and all that. But there is no evidence actually. Now, let me go back to this question of gravitational waves. See, gravitational wave is predicted by Einstein when large masses collide. Now, neutron stars were discovered about 30 years ago in X-ray astronomy and radio astronomy and all that. That neutron stars are there in the sky, are very well known. Neutron stars are, Chandrasekhar had talked about them much earlier, in the 30s itself. When a star loses all its energy, then only thing it can do is the gravitational energy that is there. It pulls it down and then becomes a very dense object, basically. That is what a neutron star is. But then why it is called neutron stars is when it becomes so dense, all the electrons are squeezed out, all the protons are converted into neutrons. So it becomes full of only neutrons and nothing else. But if you start with a mass of original star much bigger than certain which Chandrasekhar worked out Chandrasekhar limit. See, when you go to higher and higher masses, then you find that you can't stop the collapse. See, collapse was stopped because of the de-inertia pressure. But then if the mass is too much, that is why all this mass will go and become a singularity at the center of it. Now, is there a naked singularity which you can see in the sky? This is a big question mark that was there. And some theories said no, even I think very eminent scientists were involved in this. They said there is no such object, something shields the whole thing, and then there is nothing like a naked singularity in the universe. But actually, when we talk about the starting of the universe, we are talking about a naked singularity only. Basically, it is that which explodes. Basically. Now, recently, as you know, about a year ago, not even a year ago, they talked about recording a first event of gravitational wave. Now, this was done by me. It's a very, very intricate experiment. It is essentially a laser interferometer where you have a light, really, light. Keep it on. See, this laser interferometer consists of 4 kilometers long for each side. See, it's a L-shaped detector with 4 kilometers long laser detector, laser tubes. And these lasers are adjusted in such a way that the you can bring about an interferometry of the light that goes to one end and comes back, and the other one that goes to the other end. And these two, you adjust the phases in such a way that normally there is no interference. And that is recorded by a photo detector where the two meet. The theory is that when a gravitational wave is produced, then it makes the space contract or expand alternately when the wave passes through the whole apparatus. So the spacing for the lasers is reduced or increased, but then you do the interference. But do you know how much is the spacing that is changed? 10 to the power of minus 14 centimeters. Even the most powerful, the one that they detected, the displacement or the contraction and expansion was less than the size of a nucleus. 10 to the power. See, this shows the power of technology. So the laser beams are first made neutral, and then when the gravitational wave passes through, they look for this kind of a signal. And this is what they found at two places, separated by that detectors, separated by one in Washington and the other in Louisiana, and 1,400 kilometers separation. And both the interferometers, they got the same type of recording. Here, as you can see, that the red one corresponds to one station, and blue one corresponds to the other station.